From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Not all the movies, books, and music we love are refined or subtle. This week, we prove that with a series of interviews we're calling Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy. We start with movies that define big. We'll talk about the making of King Kong with film historian Rudy Belmer. Then Steve Reifel will talk about the making of Godzilla and the recent American release of the original Japanese version. And Ray Harryhausen, one of the pioneers of stop-motion animation, will describe how he gave life to creatures and prehistoric beasts in such films as Mighty Joe Young, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Big, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has once again called on the independent so-called 527 organizations to stop broadcasting political ads. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Unregulated donations in politics used to go directly to the campaigns. The McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill made that illegal. But now these 527 groups are collecting that cash and airing political advertisements critical of the candidates. President Bush spoke at his ranch outside Crawford, Texas.
I frankly thought we'd gotten rid of that when I signed the McCain-Feingold bill. I thought we were going to once and for all get rid of a system where people could just pour tons of money in and not be held to account for the advertising. And so I'm disappointed with all those kinds of ads.
527 organizations include MoveOn.org, which has criticized President Bush, and Swiftboat Veterans for Truth, which has attacked John Kerry's Vietnam War record. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Crawford, Texas.
Fierce fighting continues in the Iraqi city of Najaf, where U.S. forces pounded Shiite militia positions with airstrikes and artillery fire. The strike shook the area around the Imam Ali Mosque, one of the holiest sites in Shia Islam. The militia fighters are loyal to rebel Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose whereabouts are unknown. The Bush administration's new rules on overtime pay are triggering criticism on the campaign trail. Democratic vice presidential candidate John Edwards is speaking out on the rule package during stops in Wisconsin. Chuck Quirnbach reports from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Labor Department rules mean some workers will no longer qualify for overtime, while others can now get the higher wages overtime brings. Democratic vice presidential candidate John Edwards spoke about the rules during a town hall meeting in the blue-collar city of Racine, Wisconsin. Edwards says the rules harm too many American workers.
It's not like people aren't struggling enough to be able to pay their bills. The last thing they need is a pay cut, right?
But the Labor Department says more workers would gain than lose under the overtime rules. The Bush administration and the business community say the changes are needed because the old rules were confusing and out of date. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quirnbach in Racine, Wisconsin.
A U.S. Army Reserve sergeant said today that he'll plead guilty to some charges in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. Sergeant Ivan Frederick issued a statement saying he accepts responsibilities for his action at the prison near Baghdad. Frederick is accused of mistreating prisoners, conspiracy, and dereliction of duty. It's not clear to which charges he intends to plead guilty. Frederick is facing a military trial in Germany. In stocks, the Dow lost 37 to close at 10,073 in light trading. The Nasdaq gained a fraction to close at 1838. This is NPR News. A military court at Camp Pendleton, California, is trying a Marine sergeant accused of contributing to the death of an Iraqi prisoner. Sergeant Gary Pittman is accused of kicking a 52-year-old Iraqi man in the chest. Prosecutors say the man died shortly afterward from injuries that included broken ribs and a crushed windpipe. Pittman's lawyers say the kick was not enough to cause fatal injuries and that the man must have died from other causes, such as an asthma attack. Besides Pittman, two other Marines are accused in the man's death. A weekend full of events surrounding the new National Underground Railroad Freedom Center culminates with a public dedication tonight. Ann Thompson reports from member station WVXU.
Two children, one African-American and one white, will press their candles together to light the torch of freedom tonight. This light will lead 1,500 others across a bridge from Kentucky to Ohio. Slaves crossed into Ohio by way of the Underground Railroad if they wanted freedom. The candlelight walk is just one element of a two-hour public dedication that will feature First Lady Laura Bush and others. At a gala dinner last night, Oprah Winfrey said she hopes everybody is able to experience the new National Underground Railroad Freedom Center.
I say this is the greatest country in the world, and the price has been paid for all of us. Your crown has been paid for. Put it on your head and wear it.
And civil rights activist Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth said it would be a shame to build this great big beautiful center and not have the future get any better. For NPR News, I'm Ann Thompson in Cincinnati.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 stock index lost 2 points. It closed at 1,095. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Barracuda Networks, worldwide maker of the Barracuda Spam Firewall, spam and virus protection for businesses large and small, at BarracudaNetworks.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Not all the books, movies, and music that we love are paragons of refinement and subtlety. In recognition of that, we're calling this week Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy. All the movies, music, and books we talk about this week will come under at least one of those categories, big, bombastic, brassy, or trashy, and we admit we're fans of all the stuff we'll be talking about. We begin our series with a couple of films that help define the word big, Godzilla and King Kong.
What are you going to do?
I'll build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
A scene from the 1933 film King Kong. That was Robert Armstrong as Carl Denham, the producer who journeys to Skull Island in the Indian Ocean to capture the giant ape and bring him to New York to star in a nightclub spectacle. There are many things that make King Kong great: the special effects, the image of the giant ape climbing the Empire State Building, the great score by Max Steiner, and the piercing screams of Fay Wray, who died earlier this month at the age of 96. In 1999, I spoke to film historian Rudy Belmer, who had just written the liner notes for a CD of the soundtrack of King Kong, including dialogue and music. Belmer's other books include Inside Warner Brothers and Behind the Scenes. Here's the opening title music from King Kong. Belmer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry. Bum, bum, bum. It doesn't sound as good when I do it as when Max Steiner did it.
Well, he wrote it.
Yeah.
What would you say the importance of Max Steiner's score is for King Kong? I mean, I love the score for this.
It's a wonderful score, and of course, he was a pioneer, certainly in doing sound motion picture scores. But if you can imagine that picture, if you turn the sound off when you're watching a cassette or seeing it on television, and you turn the sound off during the big sequences, certainly in the jungle and on top of the Empire State Building and so forth, and you realize how much the sound elements contribute to the success of that film, not only the sound effects that Murray Spivak created out of roars and grunts and groans and what have you, that he manufactured, but also the wonderful dramatic values that Max Steiner brought to it. Because, you know, at that time, when he was beginning to score that in late 1932, music throughout, in terms of a underscoring, was not prevalent. It was shortly after sound came in, and the emphasis was on dialogue. In fact, background scoring was relatively sparse. But Max rose to the occasion, and fortunately, Marion C. Cooper was a staunch advocate, and so was David Selznick, who was the executive producer at RKO Radio at the time. And they said, yes, we want a full-blooded score. And it certainly became that. And he, you know, he made that thing work from a dramatic standpoint.
I love the score, but I find something very amusing about it, which is that although it's set on this island, Skull Island, the music is really very European and nothing like what would have been heard in the region at that time. And I'll play this scene in a moment, but, you know, when they first get to the island, when the American film crew first gets to the island and they're watching this, you know, native ritual.
Yes.
The natives are chanting Kong, Kong, Kong. And there's this, like, march behind them as a kind of precursor of Kong's footsteps that will be marching toward,
yes,
toward his prey. And the march is a very European form, and the brass instruments playing it are so European. And yet this defines a kind of, you know, South Sea Island or African kind of Hollywood sound.
That's true. Well, of course, Max and everybody else associated with this picture knew we were dealing with a fantasy here. It's a total fantasy. A more, as Cooper said, a more illogical picture could never have been thought up. And it is illogical if you stop and examine it from that standpoint. But the music, you know, they weren't saying, well, wait a minute, we have to get something that's indigenous to this area. We have to be authentic. We have to be like a documentary. And, you know, it was full reign of the imagination. And, of course, Max composed in a full Wagnerian manner, you know, with leitmotifs and with all kinds of percussive effects that could be used. And he just went all out. And the aspect of credibility, you forget about that because, once again, we're dealing in the world of fantasy, the ultimate world of fantasy.
Well, let's hear that scene where the film crew is observing this native ritual where the natives are chanting Kong.
What do you suppose is happening?
Oh, they're up to some of their heathen tricks. But don't go rushing out to sea.
All right, but isn't it exciting?
Sure. I wish we'd left you on the ship.
Oh, I'm so glad you did.
Wait, easy now. Wait till I see what goes on.
What a show. Hey, Skipper, come here and get a load of this. Ever see anything like that before in your life?
Pure musical delirium.
And
it.
Frenzy yeah, and delirium. Yeah. I think that would be a good team.
And that's from the soundtrack of King Kong, which has just been released on CD. My guest Rudy Belmer wrote the liner notes for it. Well, the other memorable sounds in King Kong include, of course, Fay Wray's screams and the roar of Kong himself. Let's start with Fay Wray's screams. You know, in the movie, the Carl Denham character, the character who wants to, like, wrangle Kong and bring him back for a nightclub act, he says to the Fay Wray character, he's kind of like teaching her how to scream, and he says, okay, pretend you're screaming for your life, which, of course, she later has to do. Do you know what kind of advice Fay Wray was given about how she should scream?
Well, the interesting thing is that, of course, if she had done as much screaming when they were shooting this film as it appears to be, she would have been hoarse on the fourth day of shooting. Most of her screams were post-recorded. After the picture finished shooting, they took her into a sound booth, and she did wild screams. And they used those screams, so fortunately she had one major screaming session which once again was after the film finished shooting.
And of course, King Kong has a very memorable roar. What do you know about how that was achieved?
Well, a remarkable man by the name of Murray Spivak, who was the head of the sound department at RKO Radio Pictures at the time, he was confronted with this film, you know, and thought, what can I do? It can't sound like some animal. It has to be a distinctive sound. So he went out and he recorded the roar of a lion and the roar of a tiger, and he was playing things at different speeds and playing them backwards and then combining them. And then even for some of Kong's grunts and things, he recorded himself doing in a little a megaphone type deal. So the sound is a kind of a combination of many things. It sounds like a roar, but it's not a roar that you can identify, which of course is what he wanted to do. But by altering the speeds of the recordings and taking two different animals and overlapping them, of course you can do all kinds of things.
Well, why don't we hear a nice scene with plenty of screams and roars? And this is, I believe, the first time we actually see Kong. Fay Wray is tied at the stake during another one of these ceremonies. And this scene starts with the chief, played by Noble Johnson.
Karatane Kong. Otarave Ramo Kong. Wasaba Sanamaka. Otarave Ramo Kong.
We'll talk more about King Kong with film historian Rudy Belmer after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film historian Rudy Belmer. He wrote the liner notes for a CD of the King Kong soundtrack. Now, you know, Carl Denham is the character who's the American promoter determined to capture Kong so he can create a crowd-pleasing spectacle, you know, back in New York. And I want to play the scene where he explains why he needs a beautiful actress for the film that he eventually wants to build around Kong.
You never had a woman in any of your other pictures. Why do you want one in this?
Because the public, bless them, must have a pretty face to look at.
Well, Mr. Denham, why not take a picture in a monastery?
Yeah. Makes me sore. I go out in sweat blood to make a swell picture, and then the critics and the exhibitors all say, if this picture had love interest, it would gross twice as much. All right, the public wants a girl, and this time I'm going to give them what they want.
I don't know why you're going to get her.
You think I'm going to give up just because you can't find me a girl with a backbone? Listen, I'm going out and make the greatest picture in the world, something that nobody's ever seen or heard of. You'll have to think up a lot of new adjectives when I come back.
Where are you going?
I'm going out and get a girl for my picture, even if I have to marry one.
Well, Carl Denham is certainly determined to do anything he needs to do to make this picture. Any comparisons you could make between Carl Denham and the real director of King Kong, Marion Cooper?
Well, there are a lot of comparisons because Marion Cooper was, to a large extent, Carl Denham. And Ernest Schoedsack, his partner, who was the co-director, was to a certain degree the Bruce Cabot character.
That's the love interest of Fay Wray.
The love interest of Fay Wray, who was the first mate on the junket. And Ruth Rose was Mrs. Schoedsack, and she wrote the final dialogue script. And Cooper and Schoedsack had been partners for a long time. They had done a very important documentary called Grass back in 1925, and then they did another one called Chang in 1927, where they were actually over in Siam, which was called then and later Thailand, and shot there up in the jungles with the tigers and the elephants and so forth. And they were really adventurous folk. I mean, back then, this was a big deal. And the entire company was Cooper and Schoedsack. They shot their own footage. They directed it. They set it up. They got to know the natives. So this kind of an expedition, of course, was taken to its fantasy element once again by King Kong, which was a conception of Marion Cooper's. When he was a young boy of about six, his great uncle gave him a copy of a book that was written in the middle of the 19th century called Explorations and Adventures in Equatorial Africa by a man by the name of Paul Duchalou. And in it, he's describing these terrifying gorillas, which, of course, years later, we've come to realize is not the case. But this was before anybody had really gotten to study the gorillas. And this electrified Cooper as a little kid. He said, and he told me this back in the 60s, he said, from that point on, I knew I wanted to be an explorer. Well, he did want to become an explorer, and he combined exploring with motion picture making and then later on with aviation. And he was an incredible character.
Cooper refused to use a man in a gorilla suit for King Kong. And so they went with, you know, the puppet and stop time animation. Why didn't he want to use a man in a gorilla suit? It certainly would have been a lot easier.
Well, he felt that this had to be something different. And, of course, there'd always been these men running around in gorilla suits in all kinds of movies that were made in the 20s and early 30s. And, you know, that was fine. But he wanted to do something special. And when he saw, over at RKO, Willis O'Brien, who was the chief technician, working on some stop-motion material for a picture called Creation, which was never made, and he saw these dinosaurs, he thought, wait a minute. Nobody's going to finance me during the Depression to go over to Africa and shoot a gorilla and then bring the gorilla to Komodo and so forth and so forth. When he saw that process at RKO, he thought, wait a minute, this is the way to do King Kong. So he wanted to do it via this stop motion, but to hedge his bet, he also had a huge full-size bust of Kong constructed and a hand and arm of Kong constructed and a foot, so that for some shots, for example, when he's holding Fay Wray in his hand, you've got the hand. When you see an occasional close-up of the head, it's this big, oversized Kong. But he did not want to shoot a man in a gorilla suit. He just drew the line right there.
I've always thought that Kong's size and his, you know, relative size to buildings and people keeps changing throughout the movie.
You're absolutely right on that, Terry. It does keep changing. And this, once again, was people were saying, well, wait a minute, we built him on a scale of 18 inches to a foot, meaning that he'd be 18 feet high. Yet you want to make him, he said, I want to make him, for this scene, I want to make him bigger. I want to make him 24. And they all kind of looked at him like, I want to make him 24 feet. And then on occasion he said, forget the 18, the 24. I want to make him 45. You know? So it does keep changing. But he felt that the concept, when he got to New York, he definitely had to be bigger because of the environment. And, of course, Cooper was right. Cooper had to, you know, do a lot of fighting for things that he believed in, but inevitably, I found, through the years, he was right.
Now, King Kong is really filled with a lot of bondage imagery, you know, Fay Wray and flimsy chiffoni dresses and lingerie, yes, tied at the stake on the island or pulled out of her bed by Kong's giant arm in New York. Do you think that Cooper was intentionally playing to a kind of low-level bondage S&M kind of thing?
I don't think so. I think that he just thought this would be great material. You know, I don't think he ever gave thought to that sort of thing. He obviously wanted to use a woman, and he had not used a woman, really, in his documentaries. But he did want to use, and he did like Fay Wray. He had used her in Four Feathers, the Cooper Shudsack production of 29, and he used her in The Most Dangerous Game, which is a wonderful short story by Richard Connell that he was producing concurrently with King Kong at RKO. She was in that, and she was running around in the same jungle that she'd be shooting in the jungle during the day for The Most Dangerous Game and at night with Cooper for King Kong. And for King Kong, he wanted her in a blonde wig. She was actually a brunette, which she appears to be in The Most Dangerous Game. But he thought that the Beauty and the Beast bit, that the beauty should be a blonde. So she wore a blonde wig. And he was great friends with her and admired her, and they remained friends over the years.
The blonde was probably a better contrast to Kong's dark body.
That's right. And he said, you know, he said to Fay Wray when he first talked to her about it, he says, you're going to play opposite the tallest, darkest leading man. Because she didn't really know, you know. As she got into the thing, she realized what this was going to be, but she didn't understand how it was. Because a lot of the time she was up in a tree reacting to things that hadn't really been photographed yet, or, you know, screaming in a cave or doing one thing and another. And, of course, the putting together of this film, you know, it was very difficult to know exactly what it was going to look like when it was all put together. So she had to rely on Cooper and Shudsack, and fortunately she knew them both, so that worked to her advantage.
Well, Rudy Belmer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure. And remember that big guy.
Okay. Film historian Rudy Belmer recorded in 1999 after he wrote the liner notes for a CD of the King Kong soundtrack. He provides commentary on some recently released DVDs, including The Adventures of Robin Hood, Notorious, and a special edition of Casablanca. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Denham.
Denham? Oh, that's the man that captured the monster.
Well, Denham, the airplane's got him. Oh, no. It wasn't the airplanes. It was Beauty killed the beast.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Paperbacks, publisher of A Place of Hiding, the new Inspector Linley mystery novel set on the island of Guernsey from Elizabeth George. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our series Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy with more interviews about big movie beasts. We'll talk with Steve Reifel about the making of Godzilla, and stop-motion animation pioneer Ray Harryhausen will describe how he brought to life Mighty Joe Young and the beasts in Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and Jason and the Argonauts. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Godzilla was king of the monsters, and the movie was king of all monster movies. But the Godzilla that Americans have seen is considerably different from the original Japanese movie. In the spring, in honor of the film's 50th anniversary, it was released here in its original version for the first time. Godzilla is much more than a campy or scary monster movie. It's a very bleak, somber film with echoes of the firebombing and atom bombing of Japan and direct references to the perils of radiation. You probably know the basic story. A giant, angry reptile emerges from the ocean and stomps across Tokyo, breathing fire and destroying the city. A scientist believes that radiation from H-bomb tests turned a formerly peaceful sea creature into this monster. The American version of the film deleted about 40 minutes from the original to make it shorter and to make way for new footage that was added to make the film more marketable to American audiences. The new footage featured an American wire service reporter whose reports provide the narration for the story. The reporter was played by Raymond Burr, who went on to play Perry Mason. Here's how he opened the film.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world. There were once many people here who could have told of what they saw. Now there are only a few.
My guest Steve Reifel is the author of a book about the making of Godzilla and its many sequels. It's called Japan's Favorite Monster. I asked him why Raymond Burr's character was added to the American version and why some of the film's message was changed.
Well, this was, the mid-50s, a decade or so after the end of the war. I don't think there was a lot of sympathy for Japan, so the underlying message of the film may not have resonated so well with American audiences at that time. That having been said, I don't know that the distributors of the film in the United States had purely political motives. I think they were driven more by capitalism than anything else. And what they did was essentially disguise a Japanese film as an American one. And if you think about it, what they did was rather ingenious. They rented Raymond Burr for one day. The story goes that they paid him for one day's work and they kept him at the studio for 24 hours in order to film all of his scenes. They filmed everything in a little on a little soundstage on Vermont Avenue in Los Angeles. They hired Asian actors, some of whom posed as essentially body doubles for the Japanese actors. They used over-the-shoulder shots and whatnot to kind of pretend that Raymond Burr was actually speaking to members of the Japanese cast. And they rather effectively, if crudely, incorporated him into the Japanese film. And what it did was it created a very marketable giant monster movie of the variety that was so popular at that time.
Now, the ending is really changed. In the original Godzilla, the Japanese movie that is being released now in its full version in the States, the movie ends with the paleontologist saying, "I can't believe that Godzilla is the only survivor of his species. If we continue testing H-bombs, another Godzilla will one day appear somewhere in the world." What's the ending in the American version?
Well, you know, the giant bug, giant reptile, you know, atomic monster movies were extremely popular in the 1950s. I mean, I could run down a list of really wonderful titles like Tarantula, Them, Black Scorpion, Giant Claw, Giant Gila Monster, Giant Behemoth, The Amazing Colossal Man, The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, and on and on and on. And what was the normal pattern in those films? Essentially, in the American atomic monster movies, the monsters were stand-ins for Cold War invaders. And at the end of the movie, there would be much celebration as the American military ultimately defeated these warriors, these monsters, with new and more powerful military might. Often there would be, you know, a new version of an atomic weapon that obliterated the monster. And the message was clear that no matter what the threat, you know, never fear, the American military is strong and will defend you. And what the American distributors of Godzilla did was essentially, if not completely, attempt to create an ending of that type. Raymond Burr's last line of the film was, you know, the menace was gone, but the whole world could wake up and live again. I think even in the Raymond Burr version of the film, the rather downbeat and poignant ending still shines through to a point. But in the original version, as you said, it's much more pessimistic. If we continue to test these H-bombs, another Godzilla is going to appear somewhere in the world someday. To me, what that essentially means is, in our world, that someday, you know, one of these bombs is going to be used again. And if you look around us today, I mean, it's never been more true. I mean, we're just one accident away from a nuclear tragedy. And incidentally, the scientist's prediction was correct, wasn't it? Godzilla came back again and again and again and again. And that's why we're here talking about this today.
You know, watching the movie as an adult, I was thinking, well, you know, it's the H-bomb that's responsible for Godzilla, but it's the atomic bomb that was actually dropped on Japan. Why is it the H-bomb that the movie is so concerned with?
Well, the H-bomb testing program was in full effect at this time, and there was an incident in early 1954, the Lucky Dragon tragedy, and this is really the incident that may have been, you know, the most responsible for the creation of Godzilla. The Lucky Dragon was a Japanese fishing boat that set sail from its home port in Yaizu in January of 1954, and its voyage was ill-fated from the beginning. They were originally set to tuna fish in the waters off of Indonesia, but at the last minute, the owner of the boat ordered the fishing master to set sail instead for the waters off of Midway because he'd heard that there was great catches of albacore tuna to be had there. So in late February, they began fishing there, and on the morning of March 1st, 1954, in the pre-dawn hours, a few crew members were standing on the deck when they thought they saw the sun rising in the west. And what it turned out to be was an H-bomb test. Now, the crew of the boat had not been warned that they were drifting dangerously close to the Pacific Proving Ground, the H-bomb testing zone at the Marshall Islands. And even if they had known that they were close to the testing ground, they certainly did not know that a test was going to occur on that date. So as they stood there wondering what the heck this was, a few of the men who had served in the war started to get an eerie feeling, and the captain said, "Let's get the heck out of here." And by the time they reeled in their nets, they were being rained on with this sticky white ash, this radioactive fallout. And by the time they got back to Japan, many of the men were sick. The radio man later died of leukemia that year. It became a huge international incident. And in mid-March, after the boat had returned to port, and it was starting to be, this incident was starting to make waves in the press, Tomoyuki Tanaka, the producer of the film eventually, clipped a newspaper article and went to the head of production at Toho Studios and said, "What if these nuclear tests, what if these H-bomb tests awakened an undersea creature that came on land and destroyed Japan?" And that's really the genesis of Godzilla.
There are amazing scenes of destruction in Godzilla. You know, Godzilla in the movie, he's not just a victim of the hydrogen bomb, a victim in the sense that he's become bizarre and radioactive as a result of this, but he also is a kind of like metaphor for the force of hydrogen and atom bombs. And, you know, he breathes fire and he sets Tokyo ablaze. And the scenes of Tokyo burning are really disturbing, especially if you're a child watching it. Can you describe how those scenes were shot?
Well, the miniature sets of Tokyo, in some cases, were so large that they had to be built outside to accommodate the width and the dimensions of them. They were basically shot using miniature buildings constructed in 1/25th scale. And, of course, Godzilla, as we all know, is a man in a latex costume who tramples through the set. You know, for instance, when Godzilla destroys the clock tower in the Ginza, that is a very, very accurately detailed model the amount of care and detail that went into the construction of the miniature Tokyo is just amazing. When you witness Tokyo on fire, there's a great shot during the middle of Godzilla's long rampage. It's just amazing. The destruction, the death toll, is sort of unparalleled on screen.
My guest is Steve Riefel, author of the book Japan's Favorite Monster. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Steve Riefel, the author of Japan's Favorite Monster. The original Japanese version of Godzilla was released in America for the first time in the spring. One of the things that really intensifies all the effects of Godzilla, the sense of danger, the sense of destruction, is the score. It's a fantastic score. And worked into the score are the sounds of the monster growling and the really... frightening sounds of the monster's footsteps reverberating. Tell us something about the composer of the score.
Well, Akira Ifukube, boy, what can I say? I think the score for Godzilla, of course I'm biased, but I think it's one of the greatest film scores of all time. And of course, the motifs in Godzilla were reused and reworked continually throughout the golden age of the series in the 50s and the 1960s. Mr. Ifukube is a highly regarded classical composer in Japan. He scored many films, including several classics. And, you know, without Ifukube's music, I don't think Godzilla would have made the impact that it did. The music is synonymous with Godzilla, as is Godzilla's roar, which, by the way, Mr. Ifukube created through the manipulation of musical instruments and sound effects.
Why don't we hear part of the score, and you'll hear the monster's footsteps and the monster's roar worked into it. It's music from the soundtrack of Godzilla. The sound of Godzilla's footsteps have always seemed to me to be the sound of impending doom, you know, because it's this thunderous, reverberating sound, and you get the feeling it's coming closer, you know, and so that's the feeling you're always left with when you hear these footsteps. It's like, it's coming closer. The monster or the tragedy is approaching. How are those footsteps created?
Well, there are several accounts of how that was done. It seems to have been the most logical explanation seems to be a large drum that was beat and recorded and, you know, reverb effects added to it. I don't think it was anything, you know, technically sophisticated at that time. This film really had a make-it-up-as-you-go-along you know, approach. Whatever needed to be done, the filmmakers found a way to do it.
How was the monster's roar created?
The monster's roar, boy, isn't that one of the greatest sound effects in movie history? Every kid knows it. I remember when I was a child, we used to try to imitate it too, not too much success. It was created by rubbing a gloved hand, a leather-gloved hand, over the strings of a double bass, recording that sound and manipulating it, changing the speed. And that's what they came up with. And Godzilla's roar basically was created using the same sound effects, even up until now. Now it's digitally altered, but it basically sounds the same. If you recall, during the 1960s, Godzilla's roar became more of a high-pitched whine, but it's more or less the same sound.
Do you think that the director of Godzilla, Ishiro Honda, saw it as a monster film or saw it as, you know, a parable about the dangers of nuclear weapons?
I think it's a little bit of both. Mr. Honda had served in the Japanese military during World War II, and upon his return home after the war, he had visited Hiroshima and witnessed the aftermath of the destruction there, and he was deeply affected by that, and he said so on several occasions. Godzilla is Mr. Honda's most personal film by far, and you can see the imprint that the war left on him. He worked personally on the script, you know, and he spoke many, many times over the years about how his desire for this film, while it was an entertainment film by and large, but his desire was to send a message, not an indictment of America. The monster really, that's another difference between Godzilla and American monster movies of the same time period. The American monsters usually are stand-ins, as I said, for Cold War enemies. Godzilla is not really a stand-in for America. It is more an indictment of the nuclear age. And Honda's hope was that somehow this film would inspire people to think about disarmament. I think today, if he were still alive, he'd be very disappointed that, you know, nuclear weapons are possessed by more nations than ever before.
You've seen all of the Godzilla sequels. Which do you think are the worst?
Well, the film that is fairly universally regarded as the worst of the Godzilla series is called Godzilla vs. Megalon. And, you know, this film has unfortunately been probably seen more widely than any other Godzilla film. It came out in 1973 in Japan, 76 roughly in the United States. And NBC actually broadcast it in prime time with John Belushi hosting it and introducing segments of the film wearing a Godzilla costume himself. It's crudely made. It's a lot of fun for laughs, but it's really not science fiction, you know, in any sense of the word. And yet this film really has massive exposure, relatively speaking. And I think a lot of people who just assume Godzilla is this campy, you know, monster that is good for little more than wrestling matches and goofy antics are thinking of films like this one. That's why the release of this, the original Godzilla in its uncut form, in this, you know, quote-unquote director's cut version, is so important. Because Godzilla didn't start out that way. It had serious intentions. And yes, it's an entertainment film. Yes, it's not meant to be taken too seriously. We're not talking about, you know, Citizen Kane here. I recognize that. But nevertheless, the original film and the filmmakers who created it had higher aspirations than something like Godzilla versus Megalon. And let us not forget that.
Well, Steve Riefel, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Steve Riefel is the author of Japan's Favorite Monster. In the spring, the original Japanese version of Godzilla was released in America for the first time in honor of the film's 50th anniversary. Coming up, Ray Harryhausen, a pioneer of stop-motion animation, describes bringing to life Mighty Joe Young. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Ray Harryhausen gave life to the creatures and prehistoric beasts in such films as Jason and the Argonauts, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, It Came from Beneath the Sea, and Clash of the Titans. He's one of the masters of stop-motion animation. Harryhausen fell in love with stop-motion animation when in 1933, at the age of 13, he saw the movie King Kong. The ape was brought to life with stop-motion animation by Willis O'Brien. Harryhausen's first feature film work was animating another ape, Mighty Joe Young, under the supervision of O'Brien. I spoke with Harryhausen last year.
Now, I should tell you, I grew up watching Mighty Joe Young over and over and over again. I grew up in New York, where they had a million-dollar movie, and they'd show one movie continuously all week, and the movie of the week was often Mighty Joe Young. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, so like a lot of New Yorkers, I know that movie awfully well. There's a scene where, you know, Mighty Joe Young is being hunted by people who think that he's evil and dangerous. And as he is driving with his human companions in a van, they pass a burning apartment building. And a young girl is on a high floor in this building, and Mighty Joe Young risks his life climbing through this burning building to rescue this young girl. How did you animate him getting up this burning building and then carrying, you know, this girl in his arm down the burning building?
Well, that was quite a complicated process. We, of course, shot the burning building at a very high speed as a separate piece of film. And then it was composited in the camera through a process of rear projection. Many scenes were done in that fashion. We shoot the burning building. The burning building was about 5-6 feet high. And then it was shot at 96 frames a second, which slows down the motion of the flame so that it looks a much bigger scale than it was. And then you take that and reduce it on a screen to the size, to match the size of the gorilla. And then the girl many times was animated as well on his back. And the little child on the ledge was also animated many times, intercut with the live action.
Wow. So it must have been pretty exciting early in your career to work on this.
Well, this little girl on the ledge was only 3 inches high, and she was beautifully machined with the armature inside of her. And it was a pleasure to animate this little child struggling on the ledge, almost about to fall off.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the great animator Ray Harryhausen, master of stop-motion animation. The first feature that you were the chief animator for was The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. I want you to describe The Beast.
The Beast was a composite animal. He was sort of a bit of a brontosaurus mixed with an allosaurus mixed with a tyrannosaurus. We didn't want a known beast because it wouldn't fit the story, and it would be in competition with The Lost World, which had been made in the silent days. So we had a composite beast, which they named Redisaurus.
And the premise of the movie is that the beast, this like prehistoric beast, is brought back to life because of radiation from a nuclear bomb blast.
Yes, that was the period in history when no one quite knew what would happen with the radiation of atomic blast. So the beast was a product of the unknown. He was frozen in ice for millions of years, and when the atomic bomb exploded in the North Pole, he was freed.
Was this one of the first monster, like post-nuclear monster movies?
It was an early monster movie, yes. It was one of the first. The next picture we made, It Came from Beneath the Sea, had the same basic premise, that you didn't know what would happen if the atomic bomb was exploded underwater.
And what
and
happened?
It produced this giant octopus that pulled down the Golden Gate Bridge.
So
that period, of course, destructed anything that had destruction, and it was very popular at that time.
Now, I understand the city of San Francisco wasn't wild about the idea of destroying the Golden Gate Bridge, and they didn't want you to shoot on location. Obviously, you weren't going to destroy the bridge for real, but would you remember what the negotiations were like with the city over?
Well, I think it was the city fathers who felt that people would lose confidence in the structure if they saw that the bridge could be destroyed by an octopus, even though it was a giant octopus. But we overcame that, of course, by putting cameras in a bakery truck, and secretly we shot the scenes we found necessary to use in the film.
Do you have a favorite monster, Ray Harryhausen?
I try not to have, because the others get jealous.
Oh, and boy, you don't want to be around when those monsters get jealous.
No, not when they're in that room. No, my favorite monsters are the more complicated ones, like the Hydra had seven heads, which you had to animate, and the seven skeletons took a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Medusa in Clash of the Titans. She was a fascinating image to animate. I had to keep 12 snakes in her hair, all animated to be moving in harmony so that with the rest of the body, besides giving her a bow and arrow and a rattlesnake's tail. So these more complicated images I find much more interesting to animate than the simple, normal figure, I suppose you'd call it.
You know, so many of your monsters are based on, you know, dinosaurs and giant lizards. Are there certain real lizards or insects or animals that you studied closely and based some of your creations on?
Well, yes, I do a lot of research when I create a creature. I like to make them logical. That's my theory, is that if you make them too extreme, too exaggerated, you lose your audience, because they're just a grotesque piece of whatnot. You don't know quite what they are. So I try to keep them within harmony of something they've seen. For example, dinosaurs, you couldn't possibly photograph them in reality. So we had to create them artificially. Elephants, for example, you would study an elephant as to how a dinosaur might move. You'd study a lizard, a crocodile, or a monitor lizard to try to get the reptilian feel to the dinosaur. Not to copy them. You always have to glamorize, I think, when you're making a film. That's an ugly word sometimes in today's market. But I try to glamorize the movements. I tried to glamorize the creatures, not make them just exactly the way they may have been in the early days, but photographically, so they would look the part that they're supposed to play in the picture.
Ray Harryhausen, recorded last year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Shurrock, Monique Nazareth, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Megan Howe. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the German Information Center, celebrating the Day of German Unity on October 3rd. GIC on the web at www.germany.info/unity. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our big, bombastic, brassy, and trashy week with the songwriters behind three great bombastic songs, MacArthur Park, Stairway to Heaven, and Dream On. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Recipe.